We are finally through the first part of Genesis. So today officially kind of begins part two of Genesis. And it only took us a little over a year and a half to do that. So probably, but there was a long hiatus in there. So today we're going to talk about the shift in perspective that Genesis takes, where it was very much kind of thousands of years at a time, big panoramic view of what's going on, history and kind of cosmic things going on. And in chapter 11 and 12, we start to narrow the focus down to one family and one lineage and one group of people. And so that's really kind of what we're going to start with today. Before we did that, though, I want to go ahead and have you guys watch this video from the Bible Project. And it's about the themes we've been talking about, and they just do a really good job of reminding us what we should be looking for moving forward, because 1 through 11 sets up all the themes, so they all should be there now, okay? From this point forward, we're going to be drawing on those themes. We'll be coming back and we'll be seeing them over and over and over again, but they do a really good job of kind of explaining that in this particular little video, so I'm going to have you guys watch that, and then we'll talk about it.
We've been exploring how biblical narratives work, and it turns out stories in the Bible are like any other story. You've got to pay attention to the characters, the setting, and the plot.
Yeah, these are the basic tools an author uses to help readers see the meaning and significance of the events. Now, it's time to learn one final skill that will bring all these elements together: how to detect design patterns in biblical narrative.
What do you mean by design patterns?
Well, the biblical authors have shaped all these elements, character, setting, and plot, to create series of repeated patterns that weave through story after story and tie them all together. When you notice these patterns, you'll see how different stories across the whole Bible have been coordinated to emphasize key themes.
This sounds interesting, but how do you know how to find a biblical pattern?
Well, biblical authors do it subtly. The best way to catch on is to watch them embed key words and images that link stories together. Take, for example, one of the main themes of the Bible, the complex and tragic human condition.
Okay.
So let's start at the beginning, where God is making a really good world.
Right. Seven times it says God saw that it was good.
So those are clearly important words. Now watch. God appoints two characters named Human and Life to rule this world on his behalf, and they're told that everything is good for them to eat.
Except for the tree of knowing good and evil.
So then the humans doubt God, and in Genesis we read, they see that it's good to take this knowledge for themselves. Then we read, they desire to become wise. And then finally, they take what they want.
And everything falls apart. This story is about the human condition.
And on its own, it's a really powerful story, but the biblical authors don't leave it there. They turn it into a pattern. It happens again with Abraham and Sarah. God brings them into the promised land, promises them a child. But they don't trust God, they get impatient, and we read the same words. They see their Egyptian slave, they take her and do what is good in their eyes. You get it?
Yeah, the stories match.
Then you get to Aaron at Mount Sinai, and we read how he sees and then takes the gold of the Israelites to make the golden calf. Or there's the story about Achan, who sees the gold of the Canaanites, he desires it and takes it for himself.
This pattern highlights how one person's temptation can create suffering for many people.
Exactly. It's just like the story of Saul, where we read that the Israelites see him. They desire him and take him as their king so they can be like all the other nations.
And Saul's reign leads them to destruction.
Or there's the story of David, which says that he sees Bathsheba. He desires her and then takes her and then kills her husband.
And then David's family starts destroying each other.
So you see, it's just one basic theme repeated over and over. These stories are all designed to show the temptation pattern.
Which is kind of a downer.
But the repetition builds up anticipation. Perhaps someone will come and break the pattern. This is why the stories of Jesus have been designed to carry the patterns forward to their climax.
Really?
Yeah. Like, what does Jesus say when he's faced with his greatest temptation to avoid dying on the cross?
Not my desire, but your desire be done.
So the pattern flips, and you have one person resisting temptation, and his suffering provides life for men.
Very cool. Can we do one more?
Totally. How about a big one? How God brings humanity through chaotic waters into a new world. It starts on page one, where God separates these dark, chaotic waters.
Yeah, dry land emerges as a home for humans to flourish.
Then the pattern reappears with the chaotic waters of the flood. God rescues this remnant, Noah and his family through the waters so that they can step onto dry land and become humanity 2.0. Now, does that basic storyline remind you of anything else?
Oh, right, the famous Exodus story.
Exactly. That's when God saves his chosen people from Egypt by leading them through the waters onto dry land.
While Pharaoh and his armies destroy it.
The pattern repeats later with Joshua and the Israelites.
They pass through the waters of the Jordan into the Promised Land.
Yeah, you got it. So now you can see how later biblical authors will project this pattern into the future. Like Isaiah, he hoped for a new Exodus with a new king, leading God's people forward into a new creation. And in this repetition, the nations become the chaotic waters.
So you can see how combining all these patterns brings us to Jesus.
Yeah, notice how all the Gospels highlight that story of Jesus going to the Jordan River. He goes into the waters and back out again.
His baptism.
That's when God announces that Jesus is his son, who will rescue the world from the chaos of our evil and violence by going into death and out the other side. This is why baptism became such a big deal for Jesus' followers. It's about participating in this ancient pattern, going through the waters of death, following Jesus into the new creation.
These design patterns seem really important.
Yeah, they're actually the main way biblical authors have unified these hundreds of stories together. And every pattern develops a core theme throughout the whole biblical story that leads to Jesus.
Great. That's biblical narrative, which makes up over 40% of the Bible. Now, another 30% is made up of ancient poetry.
And learning to read biblical poetry is what we'll explore in the next videos.
All right. Okay. So
we've been
for you guys that have never watched Bible Project videos, go watch. They're awesome. Okay, their series on how to read the Bible. This is just one of them. Super, super, super cool. By the way, speaking of baptisms, we had one this morning for a little one, and you've got if you worship this morning, make sure you go. They videoed it. She said her verse Joshua 1:9. It was beautiful. But that's one of those things to think about when you're thinking about baptism. Baptism is not just a symbol. It is so much more. It is literally the image of dying, coming through the chaotic waters all the way back in Genesis and living new life. And that's what it's meant to portray. And we participate with Jesus in that. And it's just such a cool thing. So, okay. So we're shifting gears, and we're talking about Abraham now. Last week, we divided up the nations, right? And then we talked about the inheritance, that the nations had been divided out to all the different lesser Elohims, and they did a terrible job, and they've been judged, right? And in the midst of all that, though, God, Yahweh, says he wants a specific group of people that are going to be his own. And we see that in Deuteronomy 32, where it says, "Remember the days of old, consider the years of many generations, ask your father and he'll show you, your elders and they'll tell you, when the Most High, Yahweh, gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. But the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob, his allotted heritage." So remember, the idea was God basically just handed many of these nations over and said, but there's going to be one group that are mine, okay? That's where we kind of leave chapter 11 with the Tower of Babel and where things are getting ready to go forward here. So, reminder of the themes we're looking for. So they just mentioned several there in the video. The see and take, that's really important. We're going to see this in Abraham's story a couple of times. And so that's really important, that idea of seeing and taking, or seeing and deciding good and bad for yourself. The movement from chaos to order. The idea of trees, cosmic mountains, and gardens. We're not going to get away from trees, y'all, just so you know. Or mountains, we'll be going there. The idea of walking with God, this whole crushing the head of the serpent and the serpent bruising the heel of the lineage of Eve. Other spiritual creatures involved that sometimes do not seem to have man's best interests at heart or Yahweh's obedience there. One of the interesting things, it's another theme I want you to pay attention to, is the idea of heading east or west. Because remember, when they got cast out of Eden, they were cast out of Eden to the east. Okay, And so now we're going to begin to see a movement in a different direction. New Adams who fail repeatedly because we keep trying to get a new Adam. You know, we had Adam, that didn't work out. You've got Cain and Abel, that didn't work out. We're going to have Noah, that doesn't work out. And now we're going to move along to Abraham. We'll see how that works out. Sacrifice and altars, the association with numbers, things like that. So I'm going to go ahead and do that. We're going to talk about numbers a little bit this morning too. So let's start with, what do you guys know about Abraham? So when I say Abraham, what are some things that you guys think of? Like, what are the stories that you associate with Abraham? Father, he's got many sons, right? What's that? Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Okay, and then Jacob has the 12, right? So, which is basically the rest of the story, right? Morning, Lance. Come on in. What else? What else do you associate with Abraham?
The sacrifice
of Isaac. Okay, Sarah was promised children in Abraham, but they were old and she was, the words used is barren. What else?
She asked her husband Abraham to take her slave, the Egyptian slave, and she told him, okay, you can have her to get kids.
Mm-hmm.
So he told her, if you insist, Sarah, and he slept with the Egyptian slave.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
The name, I'm going to try to translate the name, I'm sorry, Ismail.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry.
No.
So it's like Ishmael. So she got Ishmael, who is the father of the Arabs.
Right.
And from Ishmael came Muhammad, the prophet. From Sarah, afterwards, came Jesus.
And for Muslims, they would say that Ishmael was the child of promise, and it was actually the sacrifice of Ishmael. We'll get into that later when we get to the sacrifice. So, what else? The idea, yeah, there is this idea, and we're going to get into monotheism because this is a really interesting thing right now. The idea that that there's no concept of the Trinity prior to late Christianity, not even early Christianity, but late Christianity. But if God doesn't show up in human form, the Old Testament makes no sense whatsoever. None. And so we're going to start seeing Yahweh show up, and there's all sorts of different words used to describe him. But he is the one God. So we already know they're not monotheists in the sense that there's one God and nothing else. We are monotheists in the sense that there's a most high God and all these other created beings that do things for him, right? So, absolutely. What else? There's more Abraham stories.
God called him from his homeland. God chose him. God changed his name from
mm-hmm.
Abram to Abraham and gave him a new identity. And he also promised him descendants.
Very good. Made him promises. Made some comparisons to the stars, grains of sand, things like that. What else? He's a sojourner, left his home. Any other fun stories?
The three came and visited him, and they had the finest. It always baffled me that they just, like, whipped up a dinner. I'm like, you know, they were probably there for hours, making bread and roasted things.
There's this weird visit by three visitors. That's going to be fun. We'll talk about that. What else? So, speaking of Abraham and Sarah and their relationship, there's some other weird things that happen between Abraham and Sarah.
Just claiming that she's his sister. And
yes.
Her, like letting her be married to these kings.
Yep. Happens a couple of times, which you're just kind of like, really? So, yeah, exactly. So, okay. You guys know a lot of stuff about Abraham. That's one of those things. If you've got, you know, some sort of church background, you've probably heard sermons on Abraham. Abraham's really important for a lot of reasons. And so we're gonna spend a lot of time there. A huge chunk of the rest of Genesis is going to talk about Abraham. Then we'll shift to his son Isaac. Then we'll shift to his son Jacob. and eventually get on down to Joseph. So we'll be talking about all of those stories. So you guys actually know quite a bit. So here's the thing. If we're going to back up a little bit, if you guys want to pull out your Bibles, we'll do this real quick. I am not going to make anybody read this because that would just be cruel. But we're going to look at Genesis chapter 11 because this is where we finished up last time. And with the Tower of Babel, which is in verse 9, starting in verse 10, we get another one of these genealogies, okay? Which, by the way, will make you want to roll your eyes back in your head and not pay attention, but there's some stuff going on there. So what do we need to look for? Okay, let's think about what do we know we're supposed to be looking for? Themes.
Numbers.
Repetition of words.
Trees.
Trees. Trees. Not yet, but yes. Okay, so let's go through these. These are the generations of Shem. When Shem was 100 years old, he fathered Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. And Shem lived after he fathered Arpachshad 500 years and had other sons and daughters. When Arpachshad had lived 35 years, he fathered Shelah. And Arpachshad lived after he fathered Shelah 403 years and had other sons and daughters. When Shelah had lived 30 years, he fathered Eber. And Shelah lived after he fathered Eber 403 years and had other sons and daughters. When Eber had lived 34 years, he fathered Peleg. And Eber lived after he fathered Peleg 430 years and had other sons and daughters. When Peleg had lived 30 years, he fathered Reu. And Peleg lived after he fathered Reu 209 years and had other sons and daughters. When Reu had lived 32 years, he fathered Serug. And Reu lived after he fathered Serug 207 years and had other sons and daughters. When Serug had lived 30 years, he fathered Nahor. And Serug lived after he fathered Nahor 200 years and had other sons and daughters. When Nahor had lived 29 years, he fathered Terah. And Nahor lived after he fathered Terah 119 years and had other sons and daughters. When Terah had lived 70 years, he fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. All right. So before we go any further, what are some things you notice? Good catch. Notice at the beginning, the closer you are to the flood, the longer the lifespans. What else?
They were mostly in their 30s.
First child happens in your 30s. Except one of them. So you got Shem at 100. But then look down here, Terah at 70. So that's kind of weird. Anything else? Does this sound familiar? A genealogy like this? Have we had any genealogies before? We have. If you'll remember, the last time we had a genealogy like this, it was with Seth. Okay. So up to Noah, right? Remember we had all the generations, that kind of thing? So let's look at what happens next. So now these are the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran fathered Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his kindred in Ur of the Chaldeans, and Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarah, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. Now Sarah was barren, she had no child. Terah took Abram his son and Lot the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarah his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So we've got this lineage, right, running through, and then all of a sudden we have somebody that has three kids. Does that sound familiar? Somebody that has three kids? Has that happened before?
No.
Noah had three kids, right? And then we start extrapolating out from there, okay? So to give you guys a little bit of, there'll be lots of maps moving forward, just because now we're talking about places closer to the historical record. We are no longer in kind of the misty kind of framework of history. We're now at a part of history where when there's a name of a place, I can show you a picture, okay? Because that place is in Israel, okay? And so we'll be doing that as we start getting into some of these things. But here's what I wanted you guys to see. in terms of these places they're talking about. So Ur and Babylon are down here in the lower Tigris-Euphrates River Valley. So this is Iraq today. This is Saudi Arabia. So Iraq is up here, and Ur is down here. So when it talks about Abraham departing from Ur, we're down in this lower region, literally in the heart of where we've been talking about, Babylon, right? This ancient civilization. So it comes out of that and goes up to an area called Haran. And Haran is at the upper kind of middle area of the Tigris-Euphrates, okay? So in respect to Israel, or Canaan, as he's going to refer to it here, Canaan is this area right through here, okay? And you got Egypt over here. And this is where we're going to basically be looking at when we're talking about the life of Abram and everywhere that he goes. He's going to start up here in Haran. Then he's going to move down into this region down here. Then he's going to eventually move over into Egypt. And then we'll move back up in here. Okay, so I just wanted you guys to kind of have a framework for, okay, what are we talking about? What are these areas we're looking at? Also wanted you guys to see this. This is fascinating. So if you lay all of these numbers out, this is just one of those things, unless you're just planning on diving in up to a really nerdy level, and really kind of as a linguist, you're not going to see some of the stuff that's going on here. So you guys actually caught up on that idea that notice that the time spans for the ages start to diminish. This is not just a biblical feature, y'all. This is something that you see in other ancient texts from the Near East, and they all talk about these kings that lived for not just hundreds of years, but thousands of years prior to the flood. And they all reference a flood. So there's this idea that you had people who lived for extremely long periods of time in that pre-flood era. And as we get on the other side of that flood, you start to see time spans and ages return much closer to what we would consider normal time spans or normal lifespans. So you've got all this stuff going on. So other cool things about this. This is almost a repeat and a replay of Genesis 5. In Genesis 5, the descendants of Seth, you've got 10 generations. At the end of the 10 generations, you've also got a father who has three sons. And then you extrapolate out from what happens with those three sons. Terah has his sons at the age of 70, which is an interesting thing. There is this idea in Midrashic scholarship that says that 70 is the age at which your personality achieves its fullness. I don't know what that means, but there's this idea. I guess we'll be more ourselves at 70 than we will. I will feel like less of myself at 70. I feel less of myself now already. I'm beginning to fall apart. But so I want to read to you guys. So I've mentioned to you guys before Robert Alter's book. This is his translation of Genesis, and his footnotes are really good. And he's the one that I found some of the things about the numbering in this. There are 10 generations from Shem to Abraham as the universal history begins to focus to a national history, as there are 10 from Adam to Noah. In another formal symmetry, the 10 antediluvian generations end with a father who begets three sons, just as the series of 10 will end with Terah begetting Abram, Nahor, and Haran. This genealogy, which constitutes the bridge from the flood to the beginning of the patriarchal tales, uses formulas identical with those in the antediluvian genealogy in chapter 5, omitting and summarizing indication of lifespan and the report of death of each begotter. Longevity's cut in half and then halved again in the latter part of the list as we approach Abram. From this point, men will have merely the extraordinary lifespans of modern Caucasian mountain dwellers and not legendary lifespans. The narrative in this way is preparing to enter recognizable human time and family life. There is one hidden number game here, as the Israeli Bible scholar Moshe Weinfeld has observed. The number of years from the birth of Shem's son to Abram's migration to Canaan is exactly a solar 365. So a lot of stuff going on there. So there's a lot of like number games going on as you start kind of digging down into these things. And there's some indications that they also played games with all sorts of different iterations of 6 and 10 and that kind of thing. And it's beyond the scope of what we're doing in here today. But there's reasons behind the numbers and what's going on there. There's a symmetry and there's a poetry really kind of behind it in some ways. So here's what we're going to do next. I'm going to go ahead and, yes. Yes.
35 with the first one, 30 the next one, 34 the next one.
Right.
The next one.
Right.
So they're all alive at the exact same time. All of them.
I think that's kind of the idea. Because Shem lived 600 years, you know, his total, okay? And Terah gets down here. So, I think that's the idea. So.
But then there were other, like, fathers dying while granddads and great-granddads.
So here's the thing. Once again, a reminder. We're not looking at a scientific text. The purpose of the text really is to describe that this is the family lineage, to show that there was a lineage. And this is where we kind of get into trouble when we start trying to date things. Because, and by the way, that's very much how we come up with some of the claims for young earth creationists who say, well, the earth has to be X number of years old, something like 6 to 7 to 10,000. And they use these genealogies and they go back. And they use the numbers very literally. So that's kind of how you get these numbers, the way that they're set up. The other thing to consider is what you said. There are indications that at times they skip some of the fathers in there, that there's this idea that there's gaps in the generation, that a son doesn't always mean a son. Sometimes it means a grandson, that sort of thing. So, but yes, that is true. All right. By the way, this table is from Umberto Casuto. It's one of the Jewish scholars whose commentaries I've been drawing on. A lot of the Hebrew poetry, stuff like that, he's kind of one of the foremost guys on that. Okay, so I want to go ahead and play one more video for you this morning. This one is kind of an overview of where we're going now. And it's a really nice kind of overview of the second half of Genesis, so you guys will kind of have a preview. So as we're moving along, you guys will see, okay, this is where we're going. So I'm going to go ahead and play that, and we'll talk about it.
The book of Genesis. In the first video, we saw how chapters 1 through 11 set up the basic storyline of the Bible. God has created all things, and he makes humans in his image to rule the world on his behalf. The humans choose sin and rebellion, and so the world spins out of control into violence and death, all leading up to the rebellion and scattering of the people in Babylon. And so the big question is, what is God going to do to rescue and redeem his world? Well, out of that scattering at Babylon, the author traces a genealogy of just one family that leads eventually to a man named Abram, later known as Abraham. And God's promise to Abraham at the beginning of chapter 12 opens up a whole new movement in history. God calls Abraham to leave his home and go to the land of Canaan, which God says will become his one day. And in that land, God promises to make Abraham into a great nation, to make his name great and to bless him. Now, these promises are connected back to earlier parts of the book. So Babylon had arrogantly tried to make a great name for itself, and that didn't go over very well. But God, in his generosity, is going to bestow a great name on this no-name guy, Abraham. And God's blessing of Abraham echoes all the way back to that original blessing God gave humanity in the beginning. So the question is, why is God going to bless Abraham and his family? And the last line of God's promise makes this clear. So that all the families of the earth will find God's blessing in you. Now this is key for understanding the whole rest of the biblical story. God's plan is to rescue and bless his rebellious world through Abraham's family. And this is why the whole rest of the Old Testament story is just going to focus on this one family, eventually called the people of Israel. This is also why Israel will later be called a kingdom of priests at Mount Sinai. God wants to use them to show all of the other nations what he's like. And ultimately, this is the promise that gets picked up by the later biblical prophets and poets who say that its fulfillment will come through Israel's messianic king, whose reign will bring justice and peace to all of them. Now, at this point of the story, none of that's clear. You just have to keep reading and watch the promise develop. And so the rest of the book focuses on Abraham and his family. First, Abraham himself, then his son Isaac, and then his son Jacob, and then Jacob's 12 sons. And the stories about each generation, they're united by two main themes. So first, each generation of Abraham's family is marked by repeated failure. They just keep making really bad decisions that mess up their lives and put God's promise in jeopardy. However, God remains faithful to them. He keeps rescuing them from themselves and reaffirming his commitment to bless them and bless the nations through them despite their failings. So the Abraham stories. God had promised Abraham a huge family, but on two different occasions, he's afraid for his life because other men are attracted to his wife, and so he denies that he's even married to her, which creates, of course, all of the problems. And not only that, Abraham and his wife Sarah, they can't have children, and so Sarah arranges for Abraham to sleep with one of their servant girls, which also creates all of these problems. But each time, God bails Abraham out. And in chapters 15 and 17, God even formalizes his promise to Abraham with an official commitment called a covenant. This is a classic scene. God invites Abraham to look up at the night stars and to count them. And he says, that's how numerous your family is going to be. And despite all of the odds, having no kids and no way to have any at the moment, Abraham looks up at the sky and simply trusts God's promise. And God responds by entering into a covenant with Abraham, promising that he will become a father of many nations, that God's blessing may come to the whole world. God asked Abraham to mark his family with a sign of the covenant, circumcision of all the male boys in the family. This is a symbol to remind them that the fruitfulness of their family is a gift from God. And so Abraham has lots of kids eventually, and he dies at a good old age. Now the Jacob stories play out these themes even more dramatically. From birth, Jacob lives up to the meaning of his name, which is cheats his brother Esau out of his inheritance and blessing. He does it by deceiving his old blind father, no less, and then he just takes off. He goes on to take four wives, even though he really only loves one, Rachel, and this creates all of these rivalries in the family. The only thing that humbles Jacob is being deceived by his uncle Laban, who cheats him out of years of his life. The tables have finally turned. And so it's a humbled Jacob that returns to his homeland. And in a very strange story, Jacob ends up wrestling with God as he demands that God bless him. Some things never really change, do they? However, God honors his determination, and he passes Abraham's blessing on to him. And he renames Jacob as Israel, which means wrestles with God. Now, it's this last part of the book, the story of Jacob's sons, where all the themes come to. Jacob loves his second to the youngest son, Joseph, more than any of the others, and he gives him this special jacket. And the 10 older sons come to hate Joseph, and so they kidnap him, and they plan to kill him, but instead they decide to just sell him into slavery in Egypt, where he ends up in prison. Talk about family failure. But God is with Joseph, and he orchestrates Joseph's release from prison, and Pharaoh ends up elevating Joseph to second in command over all of Egypt. So Joseph saves the nation of Egypt during a famine. And he also ends up saving his brothers and his family from starving. And so once again, you can see the folly and the sin of Abraham's family is met with God's faithfulness, who subverts even the evil of the brothers into an occasion to save life. And this is actually what Joseph says right near the end of the book. He says to his brother, you all planned this for evil, but God planned it for good, to save many. Now, these words are strategically placed at the end of the book because they summarize not only the story of Joseph and his brothers, but the book as a whole. From Genesis 3 onward, humans keep acting selfishly and doing evil, but this God is not going to leave his world to its own devices. He remains faithful and determined to bless people despite their failures. You can see this especially in how that mysterious promise about the descendant of a woman gets developed throughout the book. So remember, Genesis 3, God promised that this wounded victor would come and crush the snake and defeat evil in his soul. And the author then connects this promise directly to the line of Abraham. This is a part of how God's going to bring his blessing to the nations. Now from Abraham, this promise gets connected to Judah, the fourth son of Jacob. And this is how. In an extremely important poem in chapter 49, aging Jacob, he's on his deathbed, he wants to bless his 12 sons. And when he comes to Judah, Jacob predicts that Judah will become the tribe of Israel's royal leaders, and that one day a king will come who will command the obedience of all the nations and fulfill God's promise to restore the garden blessing to all of the world. And then after this, Jacob dies. And later, Joseph dies.
the growing family remains in the future. And so the book of Genesis ends with all of these future hopes and promises left hanging and undeveloped, and it forces you to turn the page to see how it's all going to turn out. But for now, that's the book of Genesis.
Okay. All right. A lot going on there, right? So, okay, I wanted you guys to see that because I wanted you to, like I said, to get a preview for where things are headed. They didn't even come close to explaining all the things that happened to Abraham, but once again, I want you to start seeing those themes and how those things kind of extrapolate out. So, this is Genesis chapter 12, and this is about as far as we're going to get today. It said, "Now the Lord said to Abram, 'Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I'll show you. And I'll make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you'll be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" So what's happening here, remember, they're not in Ur anymore. They're actually in Haran. They're in the north. And by the way, a lot of the names associated with the lineage that we just read, and a lot of the names that are associated with even Abram's family here, are actually locales. So there's this idea that some of these folks actually settled in certain areas, and those locations basically were named after those family members. But at this point, he's told to leave. Now, leaving your father's house, it means leaving everything that kind of belonged to your father. So it's kind of interesting, because I've seen different commentaries approach this in different ways. Some have argued that the lineage of the worship of Yahweh continued in that family line from Babel. There are others that say, no, Abraham's unique in that he broke with the lineage of his fathers, because leaving your father's house means you leave behind the gods of your fathers. Whatever the local deity is that they would have worshipped. And remember, deities were locales, okay? So your deity was located where you were. So they're in Ur. They had a specific deity that was in that location, in that place. And sometimes you even had household deities that you associated with. So it's not clear that we know for sure that the lineage of the worship of Yahweh continued through that line. We don't. It just the scripture is not clear. However, Stephen, in the book of Acts, is going to refer to Abraham, and he's actually going to mention that while he was still in Ur, God spoke to Abraham. And we'll get to that a little bit next week when we get to a little bit more of this idea of the covenant. And so we know in some way, shape, form, or fashion, God had appeared to Abraham even before they moved up to Haran. Because remember, it said Terah actually took them up there to begin with, right? But Stephen, early apostle of the church, said that God actually spoke to Abraham before then, before they got up there. If you're reading the text, it's not terribly clear, but it feels like, hey, they moved up here. That's when Abram got this call and decided to take off. But what's more important is all the things that are being promised here, which they talked about in the video. I'm going to make you a great nation. At this time, he did not have any specific heirs. I'm going to make your name great. Now that is a direct, just like the video said, that is a direct contradiction to what we saw with the Tower of Babel story, where they said, we will make a great name for ourselves. And this is God turning around saying, I'm going to make your name great. That's not your responsibility. I'm going to be the one to do that. Once again, it's that whole see and take, right? To make your name great means you have to see it and take it for yourself, right? I'm going to make my name great, as opposed to allowing God to do it for you. And then, obviously, I'm going to bless you. This is a promise that he's going to bless him in some way, but not just to bless you. This is maybe one of the most important verses in all of Scripture. You're never blessed to just be blessed. You're always blessed for others, okay? That is why you hear it in our church, and you'll hear it a lot of times. There's no such thing as Lone Ranger Christians. We are all in community. We are created in community to be in community. When you are blessed, you're blessed so that you can bless others. That's the idea of why, we have the idea here at the church of the every member's a minister, okay? Because you're not just there to absorb the blessings. The blessings, you're meant to be a conduit. You're meant to be a river, not a Dead Sea, right? You're meant to be a conduit of the blessings. And so, you know, that's kind of one of the things that I thought about this week is of all the ways that you get blessed. My encouragement to you this week, how are you pouring those blessings out? Where do the blessings pour out? How do they pour out to your family? How do they pour out to your neighbors? How do they pour out to your coworkers? How, you know, you're blessed for others. And that was the whole idea behind Abraham here, or Abram at this point, is that he was literally blessed with the idea that this is so that others can be blessed. And we're going to see that theme over and over and over, because almost always, anybody that God uses, it's always to bless other people, okay? When he makes somebody's name great, it's always so that they are a conduit of blessings to other people. Now, this is an interesting passage. So this is follow-up on that, and it's, so Abram went as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran, okay? And if we look at the next verse, and Abram took Sarah, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people that they had acquired in Haran, and they set out to go to the land of Canaan. All right, anything jump out at you there? Took his nephew. So that's kind of, but if you consider, remember one of the guys died, right? One of the brothers died. Mm-hmm. What else?
They took their possessions with them.
Took everything with them. Okay, so I want to ask you guys, when you think of Abraham, or Abram, leaving home and headed for Canaan, what's the mental picture you have? The mental picture I had, and I don't know if it's because of the illustrations in my little, you know, Sunday school books and things like that. I don't know what it is, but I always pictured it just like him, Sarah, and a couple of folks, and, you know, and that's it, okay? I've gone back to some of these. Remember, I've been sharing with you guys James Toussaint's paintings for quite some time. This is a painter that went to Israel back in the early part of the 20th century, who basically lived in the Holy Land and then did all these paintings while he was there. So it's hyper accurate, and he tried to be hyper accurate in the way that things were dressed and stuff like that. So this is the caravan of Abram. Okay, this is probably a much better depiction of what Abram would have been like. He would have been wealthy. Okay, notice it said the people he had acquired. No, that doesn't jump out at anybody. Many had slaves. Okay, once again, this is one of those time periods in history when that idea, the ownership of other people, just kind of is what it was, right? So when we get to the latter story with Hagar, she was a slave. She was somebody and is going to be abused as a slave. So this tells you something, A, about the culture of the time, and it, B, it tells you something about Abram's wealth. And I tell you where this is really going to kind of seem even more prominent is later on. Abram's kind of a warlord also. They're going to get into some fights with some local kings, and he's going to have hundreds of guys he can round up and take to battle with him. So in my mind, anyway, I had to kind of unlearn this image of just, you know, Abram being all on his own. It's like, no, he had a pretty big entourage of folks with him and a lot of wealth. And so that's one of those things, I don't know, just kind of jumped out at me. And that's why I really like that painting. It's kind of more of an idea of what all was going on with Abram as he took off out of there and what it would have looked like. Absolutely. I will see for myself and I will take, right? I will decide what is right in my own eyes, that kind of idea, for sure.
Well, if he's willing to give his life away, these kings, why wouldn't he take a slave?
Aside from the fact that God told him, and that's, once again, that's believing a promise. And we're going to get into a little bit of the back and forth eventually. So I tell you what, let's close. Any other comments, thoughts? Yeah.
So to me, this speaks of the beginning of the pattern of an exodus. He's exiting out of an area. I mean, when he originally left Ur, mm-hmm. he leaving idols like.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you said that, because this is what we're going to close with. So here's my question. Is he going away or coming home? Because from Eden forward, there's been a lot of, the theme would be exile. You've been cast out, okay? So this is, in some ways, well, I don't know. Think about it. Which is it? He's being called out of Ur, which was probably, I would assume, comfortable. I mean, he was wealthy, right? He had everything except the thing that he wanted, which is a legitimate heir, right? So when I look at this, I've always thought of him like leaving with nothing. But he didn't really leave with nothing. He left with a lot, but he still left. Right, he still left what was comfortable. He still left what was home. I like the idea that Abram had to decide to leave, but he didn't leave. He wasn't running from anything. You notice that God was calling him to something. And I think there might be a bit of a lesson there for us also, just kind of as a spiritual practice, when you're trying to discern things. I think there are times when God is obviously trying to direct you away from things that are obviously bad for you, sinful for you, those kind of things. But I think a lot of times He calls us to something different. He calls us to something new. He calls us to something that He's for. I can't remember, oh gosh. You guys help me. Who's the guy, is it, that did Experiencing God? You guys remember the old, is it Blackaby? Henry Blackaby? The whole premise of that Bible study was find out what God's doing and go there. If you're trying to discern things, look around, see where God's doing something, go to that, okay? Go where God is. And a lot of that was based on Abraham and this idea that Abraham was calling him to something different. If you think about the folks that were with Abram, they probably were not too excited, I would assume, about leaving home, maybe. And one of the things that's going to happen as soon as they get there is they're going to find out, hey, there's people here. There's already people here. What do you do with that? Any other thoughts, comments, questions?
Mm-hmm. The way that he took the servant, as you said, he abused her.
Mm-hmm.
And he slept with her, and it was sin. So because of this sin, there was lots of consequences after that. Because of the son that he got, Ishmael.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go, Islam. And
right.
The Prophet Muhammad came from this sin. But from his wife came a blessing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And the one said.
Yeah.
So it just, he did lots of things that was not right.
Absolutely.
And it was, I feel like Sarah is like exactly like Eve. When he listened to his wife, hey, sleep with my servant.
Right, right.
And he told her, if you insist, I will.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Fine, yeah.
Yeah. So Sarah was complicit.
Yes.
They were both sinners. Okay, I didn't say that. Anybody listening online, that was not me that said that. But that is so true. I was listening to somebody this week. I can't remember where I was listening. They said, don't listen or read the Bible for how to behave. It's full of horrible people. I mean, Abram is, you know, one of them, right? And that's what's going to be really important later on, and that's why I wanted to show you guys that video. Abram, very flawed. Isaac, flawed. Jacob, his name literally meant liar. I mean, and he's the father of Israel. You know, he will be the father of Israel, and wrestled with God. And he was a terrible person. The Bible is full of terrible people. The point being, you're right, just like us, right? And the one that is faithful in all of these things is God. Yahweh is the one that's faithful. And that's what's really important moving forward. We'll get into this when Yahweh makes a covenant with Abram, which we're going to see a little bit later on. It's super cool. Weird thing happens where Yahweh meets with Abram and gives him this promise. And then we've got like animals being cut in half and flaming fire pots and things and just some really, really strange things going on. But have very important significance in that time, in that culture, in that place. But the faithfulness always fell back on Yahweh, not on the people, because the people were always going to fail. Which is why, you know, you needed that eventual Son of Man, that eventual Messianic King, that eventual person who gets it right. So I have to remind students of this, and it's always kind of cracks me up when people especially want to criticize the Bible for the things that they see it in it that are immoral. I'm like, that's a pretty shallow understanding of the Bible. Yes, they're all immoral. That's the point. I mean, they're abject, you know, deplorable people. It's a book full of deplorables, right? Just like us, which is why it's encouraging. Because it doesn't depend on our faithfulness necessarily. It falls back on Yahweh's faithfulness to us. And so, all right, well, let me pray for us, and we'll head on over to worship. Father in heaven, we thank you for the obedience of your servant Abraham. We thank you that that his faithfulness is not why we're here. It's your faithfulness to him. We're thankful that you made a way over and through our own sinfulness to call us your own. So, Father, remind us of that this week. Father, remind us to be humble. We are sinners. We are failures in so many ways. And we are good only in so much as you call us your own. So help us this week to live under the umbrella of your mercy. Remind us when we're blessed for others. I pray that you give everybody in this room an idea of how they've been blessed and how that's supposed to pour over into their circle of influence that you've surrounded them with. And I pray, Father, now as we go into worship, that, Father, you would be near us, that you would give Chris words to speak this morning. We thank you for the opportunity to partake in the Lord's Supper that you provide. And we ask, Father, that you be with us in all that we do this week. In the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray. Amen. All right. We are doing Lord's Supper. It's a devoted Sunday. And I think we're doing senior stuff, maybe. I'm not sure. So anyway, so head on over. Don't leave early. Good stuff going on this morning. Next week, we'll talk about names and what they mean, and how we get new names, and so it'll be fun. Yeah, with the wind and the, everything.
And I usually don't get it really bad. Right now, it's San Antonio, he dies. He was like, Josie, I haven't seen yellow polo in like years. Because
He's like, it's usually just dust. He's like, my car hasn't turned yellow.